is Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, and welcome to the October 2019 feature interview. I am so excited. Chico Freeman is here. He's in town. This is going to air after his Jazz Showcase hit, but he comes in town all the time. But, you know, he's a product of Chicago, moved to New York. He has played everywhere in the world. We are going to try to cover as much as we can on this interview, but I'm so glad that we got to sit down with you while you're in town here in Chicago. So, Chico, thanks for being on the show, and thanks for being the feature interview for this month.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited about being here.
I'll tell you, you know, we've been talking off camera, and I wish we were running some of that because, I mean, the stories we're talking about, just it's incredible. So, without going completely down the bio chain and all that stuff of Chico, because I could just continue to talk about it, but why don't we just kick it off first? All right, you're a product of Chicago, Von Freeman's son. Obviously, the Freeman family is just known for music in Chicago.
Fascinating.
You actually were not gravitated. You did not pick up the saxophone right away. You wanted to be a vocalist, I think, at one point in high school. That was your first instrument, is that right?
No, actually in grammar school.
Grammar school,
because
okay.
I was in the choir.
Okay.
You know, the boys' choir.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when
But how did that happen? Like, I mean, you had to have the saxophone playing all around your house as you were growing up.
Well,
right?
when I grew up, my family, my the Freeman brothers, my dad used to have rehearsals at the house. So my Uncle George on guitar, my Uncle Bruce was the drummer, and from time to time, let's see, we had Andrew Hill on piano and Don Baltazar on piano, and we had Malachi Favors on bass. My father had Malachi Favors and Leroy Vinegar on bass, and so that was the band. So we would have these rehearsals, and in the summertime, it was particularly fun because on our block, we had like 23, 25 kids. And my mom was like totally, you know, the kids loved my mom. They called her Aunt Ruby. So when my dad would, of course, back then there was no air conditioning, mm-hmm. so she would open up all the windows, and all the kids would come down, they would sit on the porch. And they would be rehearsing, and they'd be all out there listening to the music. Wow. And my mom would make lemonade for everybody.
I mean, but with your dad, I mean, they were playing, your dad was playing every night of the week, basically, right, at that point?
Well, he was playing a lot. I mean, I'm a kid, I don't know exactly,
right.
But he seemed to be gone a lot, so
yeah.
I think probably that's
But true. He was also playing with, like, some of the heavy hitters of the jazz, I mean, jazz legends, right?
In Chicago, yeah, I mean, you know, Johnny Griffin and Gene Ammons and Nat King Cole.
Were they all over at your house at one point?
I would see them from time to time here and there, you know. Later on, when I after I got out of college, you know, I used to bartend for my dad. So at the places, the clubs we were like the Enterprise, Betty Lou's, and places like that. And I would be down there, and I got to meet people like Don Byas, even the older greats. You know, that's where I met Gene Ammons and Sonny Stitt and Dexter Gordon and Norman Connors. You know, they would come down and they would play and come and sit in and play with. After they played the showcase, they come out and hang out with my dad. Clifford Jordan, you know, just a bunch of the great players at that time.
So how is it, like, when did you first, like, get influenced by jazz? Because I know that, you know, you're in the choir, and there's jazz all around you, but it doesn't seem like you were, like, connected to it at that point.
Well,
was
no.
There a moment when you, like, just like...
Of course, every kid, you know, hooks up with their peers, you know. So when I was in grammar school, I was hanging out with my... The Drifters were like the big, big hit, you know. And so I remember Joseph Cash, the name still sticks with me. He started a singing group in grammar school. And I joined that singing. I was part of that singing group. And we would sing. So I'd like to do that because I was in the choir. But when I was 5 years old, I started playing piano. So I took piano lessons from five. And then later I joined the band, but I was playing trumpet. And that's because my brother and I went... Like kids, we went down to the basement. My father was in the Navy, mm-hmm. and we found a bunch of his old Navy stuff. He was in the Navy with Clark Terry and a bunch of, you know, the Navy Hellcats, I think, was the name of that.
Okay.
It was a very famous Navy band, you know. Anyway, we went down and we went rummaging through his stuff, and we found trumpet and an alto saxophone. And just as luck would have it, I picked up the trumpet and my brother picked up the alto saxophone. So we started playing down there. My father heard all this noise. He didn't know what, because we weren't supposed to be down there anyway. We weren't supposed to be in it.
Digging around with his stuff.
He loved to tell that story too. He called, "I heard all this bleating and blatting," he would say. Because we couldn't play. Anyway, that's how I ended up playing trumpet. So I went to school and joined the band and playing trumpet. My brother also, he joined the band. He started playing saxophone, alto saxophone. So that was my introduction to the instrument. And then one day, my father had the records that they were precious like gold. We didn't want us to touch them because, you know, we'd scratch them.
Sure, of course.
One day he was out and I woke up in the middle of the night and I went downstairs and didn't, with no regard to his wishes or requests. I pulled out this album and put it on. And I sat there, and that was the first record and that was Kinda Blue by Miles Davis.
Wow.
And that was the first jazz record I ever listened to, and that's when it happened. That changed my life. And from that point on, I could only hear Miles Davis in my head as far as the trumpet. But that's the very reason I switched to saxophone.
Why is that?
Because I didn't like any other trumpet players. Nobody, I mean, Clifford Brown, you know, all of them, I could only hear Miles in my head. And I knew I wasn't going to be successful copying Miles, you know, being a clone of Miles, so.
But you weren't really thinking like being a professional musician then, right? I mean, this is like high school, right? Grade school, high school that you're playing trumpet?
Well, I not in a business sense, I kind of knew I wanted to be a performer of some kind. There were three things I wanted to do. My uncle, Bruz, the drummer, was a Tuskegee Airman. He was a Tuskegee Airman. And so he flew planes. He was in the Air Force. And so I wanted to fly planes. So that was one. The other thing, I was a basketball player, and I wanted to play basketball, too. And the other thing, I knew I wanted to perform. And I thought maybe singing, but then when I, you know, and then music. So I somehow knew I was going to do one of those three.
Mm-hmm.
And so somewhere, without me really thinking about it, you know, that was guiding me.
But you went to school, though. So when you went, you finished high school, then you ended up going to college.
Yeah.
But you didn't go to college for music, did you?
I went for mathematics. I got a 4-year scholarship to Northwestern University. But I was smart, too.
You were smart.
So they said. But, yeah, so I got a 4-year scholarship to Northwestern University in mathematics.
Wow.
So.
I mean, was that, like, with math? I mean, is that just something that drew you? You were drawn to math. I mean, it was like the science and math, what was it?
Well, I guess so. I was good at it, and I liked science and math. But the way that happened, I like a challenge, and I when I was in high school, I went to Parker High School, and the school was overcrowded, so they built this what they called Yale Upper Grade Center, so they sent all the freshmen there. And it was kind of disappointing to me because I was excited about getting my high school experience. But anyway, I went there, and the thing was, I had this math teacher, and I was close to failing math. I was getting nothing but D's. And one day, we were doing equations, and she got sick, and we had a substitute teacher. I'll never forget his name, Mr. Gaitchens. These are a few people that stand out, right? And he explained these equations on the board in a way that I could understand. She was doing it, but I just didn't grab her system, her way. But his, I got it. Then, a light went on. Then he left, she came back when she got better, and she gave us a test to find out how well we were doing. I got every question correct, but she failed me with a big red F. And I went to her and said, "Why?" And it was because I didn't do it her way.
They were correct, but you didn't do it the way she went. Yeah.
No, I did it the way I learned from you.
Right.
Because I totally understood it.
Sure.
And I argued with her, but she wouldn't change it. And I was pretty pissed. And that thing that came up in me, that thing Michael Jordan, I feel like the way Michael felt when he got cut from the basketball team.
Yep.
Felt exactly like that. So She passed me at the end of the year with a D. But then they gave us a test to find out, you know, how smart we were. And I scored high on this test along with some other guys. And they put us in a special class for the next year where most people would have three majors, you know, mm-hmm. you know, English, history, and something, maybe a language, possibly. Honor students took four majors. This group I was in, we had six.
Six majors?
Six majors. Huh. And one of the times, and I went, and the first thing I had was, and the algebra, it was algebra, this class that my teacher,
okay. yeah.
that I nearly failed. Then, but now I'm studying matrix algebra, and I'm going to Wilson Junior College for calculus, because I had three of those six majors were math.
Oh.
And I had this teacher, and he was a brilliant little guy, you know, and I don't know, I understood. So. At the end of the second years, I went back to my teacher in the other place, opened up my coursebook, and like, you ever play Bidwiz?
Yeah.
And like, bam! And I flammed it. You know, and then Michael Jordan kind of thing. So, and she disappointed me because she looked at it and she said, oh, congratulations.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I couldn't stay angry at it. So that was it. Anyway, at the end, I ended up getting a scholarship.
Yeah.
Because of that.
So you weren't really playing that much then, right?
I played trumpet in the band.
Right?
Yeah, I was playing trumpet.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I kind of stopped for a while I was there because I six majors and trying to play basketball and you know all of that kind of stuff. Yeah.
What drew you back? What drew you
to
back to the music? Yeah, because you're in college at that point, right? I mean.
Yeah. Well, when I got to college, when I was at my first year at Northwestern, I'm taking all these math courses and the first year. I thought, okay, I felt like getting into music, doing something. So I decided to see if I could join the band, just...
like the marching band?
Yeah, because it counted as an athletic thing, because it was the marching band.
Okay.
So it counted as an athletic thing. And so I joined the marching band. And I got to travel, too, to the, you know...
Oh, you got to go,
Michigan,
yeah, it's a Big Ten school.
Yeah, so that was cool. So I did that, and so I was still playing the trumpet then. But then... my second year and third year, you get to a point in mathematics, at least the way they did it then, where it splits off in two directions, practical, and kind of infinity mm-hmm. series, and abstract.
Okay.
And what I learned was that mathematics was so far ahead of science. So, for example, all the things that we know now. With the space launching and all these things, mathematical things, that they didn't know then, math knew. Then science finds usages for it. They find how to make it practical. And that excited me. So I decided to go off in the abstract direction. One of the reasons I was open to experimental music, mm-hmm. avant-garde music, but that direction. And at that time, I started getting recruited. I was recruited by IBM and the space... Kennedy,
NASA.
I was recruited by them, IBM, and another data control, I think it was. Okay. They had a company back then, and I was seriously thinking about doing that. The other option I saw as a mathematician was to become a professor, you know, or do that stuff. But I don't know. I just had this thing about moving around. At that time, I was starting to go down and see my father at the jam sessions, the Enterprise, Betty Lou's, those clubs, and seeing these people.
Yeah.
Like I just mentioned to you before. Did I mention that on camera? Or not?
Dexter Gordon, those guys.
I started, that's when I slowly started to turn. So then I decided that I wanted to change majors and switch to the music school. But I decided to take trumpet lessons, and I had a teacher. I decided to switch to the music school in trumpet at that time. And so I was taking trumpet lessons, and I still had miles in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to my classical teacher, and I was so excited. I brought that album, Kind of Blue, and I said, listen, check this guy out, right? And my teacher, and I liked the guy. He was a good guy, you know. When he came back, he had not a thing positive to say about Miles.
He's a classical trumpet player, right?
He's listening to Miles. Yeah, he was like, he plays out of tune, and he's just this, that, that. I said, that's Blue Notes, man. That's not out of tune. You know? He just didn't get it. And that at that point, I thought, oh, I can't stay in this, you know?
Yeah.
But I decided to go into music education, you know,
so you had something to fall back on, right?
Yeah, actually, I didn't never thought like
that. Oh, no?
That. No. I subscribed to that Eddie Murphy comment. They asked Eddie Murphy, did he ever think he needed something to fall back? He said if he had thought that way, he set himself up for failure from the beginning. So I never thought that way.
Yeah.
But, no, I just thought, I wanted to learn as much as I could about other instruments as well, so I thought it would be good. So in doing that, I had to take string instruments, mm-hmm. And I also had to take woodwind. And when I got there, all the clarinets were gone, so the only thing that was left was alto saxophone, which reminded me of my brother, you know, from movies. So yeah. I took the alto saxophone and I played for, you know, a quarter, because, you know, Northwestern's on the quarter system.
That's right.
And during spring break, which was in March, if I remember correctly, everybody was leaving to go, and there was a tenor saxophone in the room, and I asked my teacher if I could take the tenor saxophone home. And I took the tenor saxophone home for 2 weeks, practiced 10 hours every day for 2 weeks. I didn't go to, what's the place everybody goes on spring break?
Cancun?
Yeah, no, Florida. You know.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about, places. Yeah.
Everybody is going.
I've never been there.
I went there inside 2 weeks.
Daytona Beach.
Yeah, Daytona. So I come back, you know, after spring break. And I go to the band director and I say, hey, I said, you know what, I'd like to join the band. And he looked at me crazy. He says, you're already in the band. What are you talking about?
Right.
I said, yeah, I'm on trumpet. I want to try it on saxophone. And there was this guy. He was from Texas, southern guy. Let's say that I didn't think he was a big fan of mine. He didn't really know me that well, but it was more from where he came from.
Right. Yeah, right, right. You understand? He's a little biased.
Yeah. And he was like, this is Northwestern. This is not, this is the Harvard of the Midwest. This is the, what's the famous school in New York, Juilliard.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He's like that. And I listened to that. And I said, look, because I had to audition. I said, you have the power to say no. I said, but you don't have the power not to let me try. So I auditioned and made it. We had to. So now I'm in the band on saxophone. And I'm studying with Fred Hemke, who I liked him anyway because I was playing his reeds on soprano.
Oh, yeah.
Hemke reeds, yeah.
Yeah.
That's so I'm in this. So now I'm playing in the saxophone quartet, classical music, and I've got this classical mouth, everything cool. And Fred is, he's cool with me. It's all good. Then one day I go down to play with my dad at Betty Lou's, I remember, and Clifford Jordan was there. And I felt like, okay, I kind of can play now.
Had he heard you play yet? I mean,
Yeah.
Like sax, like.
Yeah, at home. Yeah, I mean, at home, I would go there, and he would never let me go. But he had heard me there.
Okay.
But not out, only practicing.
Yeah.
So now this is my father's Von Freeman. So this is serious, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And everybody's coming down and can play. I mean, Clifford Jordan, all these great musicians, and I'm thinking I'm ready to do this. And so I said, okay. And my dad's cool. His chest is out like this, and Clifford said, okay, let's see what Von's son sounds like. Man, I got up on the stage, and I start to play, and my sound will sound like tearing paper. So tight, just.
Compared to those guys, man, it's like a whole other ball game, right?
Mike. Painful. Not only to me, but I look at my father and his chest would. Clifford was like. So at the end of the night, I was going to go back to school. My father said, come with me, you come home with me. And so I went home, and he went upstairs. He had opened up a drawer and had a cigar box full of mouthpieces. And he went rummaging through, and he pulled out this mouthpiece. He said, try this. I put it on. All of a sudden, my sound went, boo!
Really?
I was like, wow.
Yeah.
And he said, you take this. He said, I was making this for me. He said, but you needed more than I do.
So it was, it was really, the notes were there pretty much. Yeah. It was the sound,
the notes mean nothing without sound. You know that. So,
you know, that it's interesting you brought that up, too, because, I mean, now you're playing sax and all that at that point, but I want to kind of vamp a little bit because, you know, Chicago's known for that big tenor sound, man.
Absolutely.
You know, Jug, yeah. Your dad.
Johnny Griffin.
I mean, you know, you can go down the list, right? I mean, so it's interesting to me that you brought that up with the sound thing because, I mean, that's like the signature Chicago sound. You have that sound that you've even developed even more. Was that even in your mind until that happened to you? And then what happened once you heard that? You were like, "Whoa! How could you go back to Northwestern with that sound now?"
Well, this is kind of this interesting. You mentioned this that you bring this. Of course, after he gives me the mouthpiece, he says to me before I leave, he says, "You can play 1,000 notes, but if you don't have a sound, no one will hear you." He said, "Or you can play one note. If you have a sound, everyone will hear you." That was the advice he gave me walking out the door. So I go up to Northwestern, and I'm like thrilled, man. So I come back the next day for saxophone quartet rehearsal with Fred. We start out, and I'm boom, big ass sound, and just and Fred is going, "Oh my God, what happened? What did Chico? What?" And he's like, "Oh, stop, he stops the band." I said, "Yeah." He said, "What?" I said, "I got a new mouthpiece. Isn't it great?" He said, "No."
Not for that.
Oh, he was out.
Yeah.
And there's a very ironic thing that happens to this. He says, "No, this is classical music. We want everyone to sound the same."
That's true, though.
It's absolutely true. So that was my first lesson, you know. So
yeah.
I went back to my old Selmer C-Star, you know, and played the rest. But then I'd go on the weekends, I'd go and switch up mouthpieces and do that.
How hard was it to switch? Because I'm curious, because I want to talk about that a little bit. How hard was it to switch back and forth? And then how long do you think it took for you to develop? Because I always like asking people this that are like as accomplished as you and have recorded as much and played with so many people. How long was it before all of a sudden you decided, this is the sound I'm happy with, this is me? This isn't me copying other people. This is like it.
Well, the funny thing is, I didn't have a saxophone at that time. I had still was playing that.
You're borrowing the one from Northwestern.
And it was a Bundy, model.
Selmer. My brother had a Bundy. Yeah. I sold it for $20.
I didn't have it. Then one day I went to a repair guy with the Bundy. You know, he needed a little repair. I forget who the guy. I wish I could remember him because he actually changed. Was a pivotal point in my development. I went there and gave him the saxophone, and he said, "You know, you need a professional." I said, "I can't afford, you know, I don't have money for that." And he said, "Well, look, you should visit pawn shops," he told me. And he said, "If you find a Super Action 80, a balanced action, he said, "This saxophone is good." And he said, "Even if it's in bad shape," he says, "don't worry about it. You pick it up and you bring it to me and I can fix it up."
Yeah.
So as luck would have it, some days after that, I started visiting pawn shops, and I found this pawn shop and I found a saxophone that it was only $100. So I took it, but it was pretty in pretty bad shape.
Yeah.
And I took it to him and he fixed it up. And that's the saxophone with my father's mouthpiece that I played on all my records, records, and with Elvin Jones and Sun Ra and
that McCoy. Sax.
Yeah, that's the saxophone. I mean, until
wow.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward a little because I know you and I could talk forever, but I that's the perfect launching point because let's talk about you're in Chicago, you're starting to play, you're doing all this stuff, but then you ended up how did you end up in New York? Because
I started getting good. I was practicing a lot and getting good, and I started playing and experience. You know, I was playing in R&B bands and stuff like that.
Yeah, because you were playing all different genres here, right?
I mean, I'm a musician here. I'm just playing where I can get the gig. And then
did you do something with Earth, Wind, and Fire?
I played with Earth, Wind, and Fire when Mike Maurice was here. I was in that band for a while, and I met some people there. And then at that time, the Regal Theater was happening. And the Regal Theater had, during my time, you know, they would bring Motown Revue and Dionne Warwick and, you know, Temptations, Isley Brothers, right, yeah. All of these people, Stevie Wonder, little Stevie Wonder. And then also there was another place that they played, well, Lou Rawls, you know, and another place where the Dells and the Spinners. Remember that group?
Those sure,
were,
yeah.
And the Delphonics. Mm-hmm. So there was a gig. I still was playing. I was playing with Street Dancer.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, through this Stankowski. Right. Yeah, he's a great guy. Cause I was playing, and I was playing the blues clubs. You know, I would play up on the north side with all.
Yeah, because it's Chicago, so you're in the Chicago blues scene, south jazz, side.
I played with Junior Wells and J.B. Huddle down at Checkmate and those blues clubs on the south side.
Yeah.
So I was just playing everywhere, and but then I got a gig to play in the band behind the Spinners or the Dells, or you know. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy, his name was Donald Myrick. We called him Hipmo. He was the leader of the Phoenix Horns that played with Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Oh, yeah.
And he also recorded with Phil Collins, the whole, mm-hmm. you know. And so Donald, I went there for the first time. The saxophone player got sick, tenor player got sick, so they called me. I came in, and I'm sitting next to Donald. He's there, and I'm here. And I had never, this is new experience. So I'm there, and they put the music, and I got to sight read everything, because there was no rehearsal.
Right.
So, cool. But, you know, if you've ever been in those bands, you know how the music can look. Donald was great. He helped me through everything. He just, okay, we're going here now. Cause it's not as much as it is directing your eyes to where you got to go next.
Yeah.
You know, okay, they jump.
You're not playing all the time, and then it jumps, and then you're here.
Exactly.
And then, yeah.
So he was really helpful. He said, we go here, then we go there. We did such a good job together, they started calling us together as a team. So he and I became really close, and I started playing. I played with Isley Brothers, Temptations, Four Tops. I played with everybody.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson, you know,
the
Jackson Five. And so that's how that happened. So I'm doing that now. I'm kind of going around, and then there's this other band, local band, Thunder Funk, Symphony, Jesus Wayne's band, and I'm playing with this. I'm on the road, opening for a different. And then I joined Earth, Wind, and Fire because Maurice was still in Chicago. This was before mm-hmm. he went to California. So I'm doing all that and having the ball
having
being
a good
musician.
Time, I bet. Excuse
me, having the ball being a musician. Yeah. So then in Evanston, there was a place called The Amazing Grace. It was a great place. It was like I guess you might could call it like a cabaret theater.
Okay.
It was a theater, but then it had tables also. It was a combination of a nightclub mm-hmm. theater. And Charles Mingus came there. And I asked Charles Mingus if I could sit in. I went there. Again, I was brave. And this is where I learned.
And Charles Mingus is pretty intimidating, right?
You have no idea. Extreme. Plus, I knew his history. Charles Mingus, if you messed up, the worst thing you could do to him was mess up his music. And if you did, he would stop the band, call you out.
In front of
like
everybody.
You're the drummer. He would say, he'd stop the band, you know, and say, excuse me. He says, you guys paid to hear professional people play this music. It appears our drummer didn't get the message. And I mean, really, and he says, so we're going to start the song over again. Maybe he'll learn his part in that bar. He was brutal. And he was known for hitting people.
He punched somebody out one time.
So,
yeah.
I don't know why I was so brave at that time. I went up and I asked him, and he said, yes, it was okay with him, but I would have to ask George Adams, who was the saxophone player with him at the time. So I learned two lessons. Number one, no matter what, he respected the musicians that were in his band. I could not have done that without George's permission.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one lesson. The other lesson I learned is because when he'd be nice to call the rhythm changes or the blues or something. He called one of his songs that spanned three music stands. You literally had to walk down the hall. And I'm like, oh, so the second lesson I learned is if you're going to go to someone and ask them, play, you know, to sit in with it, make sure you know their music. Anyway, I did a good job. And George, again, like Donald, was, again, great guy, very helpful. He could have been terrible, but he wasn't. Afterwards, I was leaving. I went over to thank, because, you know, he was pretty big. He had to sit down.
Mm-hmm.
I went to thank him for letting me sit in. I was about to leave, and he said, hey, you should come to New York. He said, we play at Boomer's every Saturday. You come and look me up. I was like, okay. So that gave me the idea that I could go to
New York. And confidence probably too, right?
I felt I could go, yeah.
You know.
So that's how I didn't go until later because I decided to work on my master's degree. So I went to Governor State University for my master's degree and Warwick Carter, that's where I met Warwick. And during that time, we joined the the Monk Institute and what they do with the, like, Joshua Redmond.
There's been some people from Chicago that have been a part of that.
I was a part of the, I went to that school and we were in the Notre Dame Intercollegiate Jazz Festival, which did the same exact thing. And we competed. And the school with Warwick, we won 5 awards. I won 2. I won the best saxophone and the best soloist. And we won the best arranger, Randy Harris, and a singer, I think, and something else. We won 5.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, we got the opportunity to go to Brazil in an exchange with the governor of Illinois and the governor of Sao Paulo, in Sao Paulo.
Yeah.
So I went to Brazil because of that. Went down there and had a great time down there.
I bet.
And
there's a lot of music down there.
Yeah,
man.
And on the way we flew from Chicago to New York and then New York to Brazil. And then from Sao Paulo, I should say, Sao Paulo to New York. And I decided, because back then the airlines were a lot different, they allowed you to, you could have layovers. You didn't have to just...
I could lay over a couple of days.
Yeah, they allowed that. I said, okay, I don't want to just make a change. So I decided because Fred Hopkins, Henry Threadgill, they had gone to New York. So I decided I would stay. So I called up Fred at the airport.
So you're at the airport?
I'm at the airport. And I thought, why might not I just visit, see how New York is like? And I asked Fred, I said, Fred, can I stay with you a couple of days? He said, yeah. So... I come in, I fly in, and I decide to go. I tell the airlines I'm going to be here for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go, and Fred's living in this loft with David Murray, Stanley Crouch, and Philip Wilson. So, and now me. And I figured I was going to stay there for 3 days.
Yeah.
That was, you know. After the first day, I go down there, and Henry says, Chico, listen, I got to go to Chicago. No, sorry. Yeah, Henry says, I got to go. And there was a Tin Palace downstairs. He says, listen, can you sub for me with Gene Lee? I said, okay, sure. So my 3 days turned into, because I had to stay the weekend because she was playing the weekend. And then she did so well, the Tin Palace asked her to come back. So my week turned into 2 weeks. So, you know,
so you're there.
And Henry did. So then he comes back. Then I meet Oludara while I'm there. And Olu's taking me around because I'm kind of like it. So he was working at a place called Dr. Generosity with Michael Carvin and Mickey Bass. Mm-hmm. So I go up there and I sit in. So I sit in with them. And Mickey says, come on, join the band. So now I'm playing. And this is every weekend. So now my 2 weeks turn into a month more. And I'm there every weekend. And so I'm playing with that. Then I come back and I meet Cecil McBee. And he's got a band and he's playing. So he asked me to come and play there. So now I'm playing with John Stubblefield.
Oh, John from Chicago. Yeah, sure, yeah.
So John got a gig with Nat Adderley. And he called me and says, Chico, can you sub for me with Cecil? So I do that. 3 months. Now I got to find some place to stay.
Yeah, right, you're not staying there anymore. Yeah. It's like,
so I actually slept on a couple of park benches for a while.
Did you?
I was homeless for a minute, yeah. But then I got...
But that was back in the day when you were doing that, you were able to do that.
Yeah.
Meaning, like, you could go from one club, meet these guys, go to the next club, and there was enough work probably, too, right? There's
a lot
of stuff.
Well, I didn't know that. I had no idea I was going to be working like that.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
And then the next thing I know, Sun Ra called me, so he wants me to play with him, so I go to play with Sun Ra.
Is he in New York then?
Well, he's in Philadelphia.
Oh, Philadelphia, okay.
And then Eddie Moore, great drummer, you know Eddie.
Sure,
he played with Sonny Rollins and everything. Eddie's playing, Rigmore Newman, Joe Newman's wife, she had a place, 52nd Street. She reopened the 52nd Street Club.
Yeah.
It was a famous one, but
on
52nd Street, she opened that club again. And he was down there playing, and I went down to see him because I knew him. He was a friend of my uncle's, George. And there, and he's there, and with Calvin Hill and Roland Prince, who's playing with Elvin Jones. And I sit in. And Roland said, hey, you know, you should call Keiko and Elvin. Elvin's looking for a saxophone player. I said, okay, here's the number, call Keiko. So I get up the next day, go to a phone booth.
I remember phone booths.
Yeah. Give Keiko a call, and she says, okay, we're playing the Vanguard, so come down.
Elvin's playing at the Vanguard, so come out over. Yeah.
Now I'm thinking I'm going to audition, right?
Sure,
so I decide to be a little late. Not late, but I didn't think I had to be on it because she didn't say be there. She just said come down.
Right.
So I'm thinking I can come down, sneak in, sit in the back, listen.
Yeah.
Get a... She sees me walking in the club down the stairs. She panics. You got to go. Yeah. Like, I was late. I was like, oh, man, I would never make this kind of impression. You know what I mean?
Right.
We just talked about that, right?
Right.
So she takes me, you know how the van, you've been to the van. Yeah. So you know on the side, go up to the side. On the side. She says, take out your horn. She take out my horn. She pushes me on the stage.
You had a gig already? You were...
I don't know if I had it, but she pushes me on the stage. I'm standing, and Elvin's playing, and Elvin's like, And he looks over at me, and I'm like, and so Pat LaBarbera, you know, Elvin liked to use two tenors, so Pat LaBarbera was playing. I have no idea what they're playing. I don't know what key they're in, nothing. So I said, Pat, what song is this? Pat wasn't nice. He wasn't like Don Myrick or George. Pat turned his back on me. He turned around, looked the other direction. He turned his back. I said, oh, it's like that. Welcome to New York.
Yeah, right.
So Elvin, after they played, and then Elvin looked at me, okay, you play. So I went in my ear and I just played.
Yeah.
Then I said, so, because I said, Pat, tell me what, I said, at least tell me what key we're in.
Right.
He didn't talk to me at all. So then Elvin, they knew what the next song is. They started the next song. I said, I'll give it one more shot. Pat, what song is this?
Nothing.
Nada. So I played that one again.
Yeah.
I did not think I had that gig.
Mm-hmm.
So after that set was over, I turned around to pack up my horn. Keiko come, you want a job? I said, of course. And I played the rest of the week and went on tour with her.
Wow.
And that's how that's how I joined Elvin. That's how, and I never came back to Chicago.
No, that was it.
That was it.
You still have a layover flight that you can use?
I got the ticket somewhere. No, the flight's gone.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah. I mean, so that really kind of, that's how you kind of boom and you launched into your
that's
the deal.
How it
you were with, so you got to play with Elvin. You also got to tour and play with McCoy.
I played with McCoy for 5 years.
Yeah.
I played with Jack DeJohnette for 5 years. And then I worked with Max and Billy. Well, Billy, I started my own groups, and I had great bands. I had Reggie Workman was in my band. Cecil McBee was in my band. Buster Williams. I had Al Foster, Ron Carter.
Had everybody in your bands because everybody.
And you know who I had in my band, which was one of the greatest guys, the drummer with Mingus, Danny Richmond.
Oh yeah.
He was amazing. He was just amazing. We toured, we had like 3 or 4 week tour in Europe. He's the only guy that didn't have an off night.
Ever. Really?
Amazing. His consistency was inhuman.
You know, it's interesting because that leads me down the road that I want to ask you about a couple of different things from composition-wise and stuff, because you write a lot of your own music. Mm-hmm. When we were coming over here today, mm-hmm. we were talking about that and talking about the original compositions. But since you brought up the off night, having an off night, I think it's real important, and I think it's interesting for young musicians especially, but also even seasoned veterans that are playing around town, doing their thing, doing whatever, even educators. But somebody on your level, it's a whole different ballgame to walk in front of a room at the Vanguard or whoever, with Elvin or with your own band or whatever, and hit it and be at this level. Like, boom, there's like intensity, everything's just gonna be popping. Because that doesn't happen a lot of times when you're not used to doing that, right? Mm-hmm. So how did you get to, what went through your mind, or when did you realize that, like, this is just the way I sound and I'm playing at this level? Because you must play with guys that you get into a room and you're playing at this level, meaning intensity-wise, meaning you're throwing down. Here it comes, first tune. It could be at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and 9 o'clock at night. Doesn't matter. This is what's happening. And guys are going through the motion and they're playing. I just think that there's a mind shift at some point in a professional musician's mind where it's like, I got to play at this level all the time because this is me and this is where I have to be if I want to be at this you know, part of my career. Was there, is that just something that you learn or is something that just happens? Or?
I think it comes more from when you do it over and over again and yeah. you have to do it. And the more you do a thing, the better you become at it. So there was a time I felt that there was a little bit of a letdown in general mm-hmm. from musicians, from the older guys. But then, and I thought I attributed it to the fact that Mingus used to, he was the house band at Slugs or, you know, and yeah. he played for a month every night. Then they would go on tour.
Yeah.
So they, guys had that opportunity to do that. That's how they kept bands together. And you look at the groups that had, you know, the Modern Jazz Quartet, the Charles Mingus, they, you know, Coltrane, Miles, they would have bands that lasted, you know, and stayed together.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way I saw that was, the only difference I saw was the fact that they would be able to play, they would be the house band or play a place for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, a month, 2 months, you know?
Yeah.
And then take off, and then somebody else would come in and be the house band for another month or two. And that was great. It was hard back then, a lot of times, to have that, you know. In fact, I don't think that's ever come back. That's why when I used to tour, I loved to play at Ronnie Scott's in London back then, because I got 2 weeks, and I was one of the only few bands that he'd give a month to.
Wow.
And but though I'd love go, I was 2 weeks in London with one night off each week. But when I would tour with, like I toured with Don Pullen, we had 6 or 8 week tour, one night off.
That's it. So every yeah. night you were there.
And that particular tour, there with Don Rashid Ali had a club in New York. Mm-hmm. He was a drummer with Coltrane, yep. too, after Elvin. And it was called Ali's Alley. And we toured for six or seven weeks in Europe. And we were, like, on that level, like, just.
You guys could wake up out of bed.
I didn't think that we could get higher. But every night, it got higher and higher and higher and higher. And when we came to New York, we flew in, one day, and when we started at Ali's Alley. And when we walked in that place, I remember the last three nights, the last night we were there, we were playing so incredible that, and he was supposed to close. So he turned off the lights. He told everybody, the outside lights, he told everyone, he said, you can leave now or not, but if you stay, we're going to close the door and lock the door. Everybody stayed. The place was jamming. Nobody left. He closed the door, locked it, made it look like he was closed.
Yeah.
And we played another, because we still had it in us. I mean, we were done. We had played all the sets, hit that last set, and I saw myself leave my body, and it just was on. And the people were there. I wish that my father always said that those great magical moments are never recorded.
Yeah, right.
They're never recorded. That was one of them, and wow. that was after like 8 weeks of constant playing, yeah. and that was the last night, and it was just amazing. So I think that those guys played all the time. I think that helps you.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and that's you, right? I mean, you play all the time. Well, yeah. you played all the time, and now you're playing all the time, and that's how you get to that that level. That's probably the key, right? Yeah. And also a mindset too, though. I think you know at some point because I mean you.
Well, they got about 72 games at the NBA in the or 75, whatever they got.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a lot of playing, you know.
Yeah, and they finally get to that level.
That's that. Yeah.
So also, you're writing a lot of music. You've written a lot of music, and we were talking about this new project you're starting to put together here in Chicago, which is going to be really exciting. I don't know how much we can talk about that, but as far as your compositions, I'm always curious too, from a saxophone player or just a soloist. All right, so you write a tune, you compose a tune, you're the composer, arranger. Then you get into a room, you got the band, you got to rehearse. Now you have to be the sax player, the improvisationalist. Do you take yourself out of the compositional role? Because it's to me, that's kind of difficult. If you write the tune and everything, and now I'm going to solo over this. Now you wrote the thing. So if you don't like what's going on, you can just change stuff. Or do you, this is what I wrote, this is the way it's going down. Do you have to have like a brain shift when you're now the guy playing over your tune? Like, are you taking yourself out of the compositional role, I guess is my point.
Mm. Sometimes, yes. Because I have to open up, I like to open the doors for the players to contribute. I never tell them what to do.
Right.
Because I don't want them inside my head. I don't want them in there at all. I wrote the thing, and I want them to react to what it means to them, or you know how it does.
Mm-hmm.
So I do take myself out, and I leave it to them, and then we play and we see what's happening. I played 2-3 times maybe before. If I have something to say, it'll only be if I really don't like something that they do. Then maybe I'll speak up, and then I'll find out. So, yeah, I usually take myself out, give them the opportunity to find out what it means to them. And then if we end up doing something differently, I never argue about what we're going to do, never. If we have a differing opinion about how something should be done or go, then we stop and then we say, okay, let's play it. And you play it each way and give it all you have.
Yeah.
And then the music will tell you what works for this group of guys or this group of musicians.
Yeah. Because to me, that would be really difficult. I mean, you've written a lot of music over the years. Mm-hmm. And you've played with a lot of different personnel in your groups and stuff. So each tune's probably got a little bit of different, you know, depending on the personnel and all that stuff. But as an instrumentalist who wrote the tune... It's interesting to me that you can separate from that and say, okay, you know, you put your ego by the door and say, all right, this is what it's going
to
sound like with this group.
Everybody has to check their ego. You check it. There's kind of. I don't mind. Everybody has to have an ego just to get up on the stage. You need it. Mm-hmm. I just don't want any ego problems.
Yeah.
So I expect ego. I mean, I expect confidence and all that. That's great when you have an ego, but no ego problems.
Right.
So I don't mean to say check, because you have to have it. You need it, you know, to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about, so you've got a project that you're working on for 2020 in Chicago, I think, and we're talking a little bit. How much can we talk about that?
Talk a little bit about
tiny
it.
Bit. But you're actually, we'll touch a little bit about that, but I also want to talk about, since this is coming out October 1st, we can talk about what you have coming up October, November. You're going to Europe, you're going to Switzerland, you're doing a lot of different stuff here.
Yeah, I'm taking this project to Switzerland in November.
Okay.
And it's called Chico Freeman Voices of Chicago. And it's a mix of jazz and gospel together, and it's dedicated to my grandmother, because you know, my family, as you know, my dad's gotten his due, and my Uncle George, and you know, people know the names, but they don't realize that their mom was a gospel singer who sang with people like Mahalia Jackson and the Clara Ward singers. So I want to give her some. So my brother, like I say, she needs some ink too. So
oh, for sure. Yeah. She's the one that's probably started the whole thing.
Yeah,
right?
My uncle's playing guitar because of her.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure she gets some, you know. So this project's dedicated to her. And I've picked some singers here that are some of Chicago's finest singers.
So it's going to be a combination, jazz, blues, gospel, everything put together.
Put together all that.
It almost reminds me of like the, you know, with you, I mean, you play all these different genres, so it's almost like you're also paying a little homage to how you came up too, right? All these little influences from Chicago.
I grew up with my grandmama, and she introduced me to gospel music. I mean, she was church and everything. I listened to her sing and play gospel, you know, sing gospel. My grandfather was a piano player and one of the first black policemen on the Chicago Police Force.
So oh, really?
His best friend was Louis Armstrong. My dad and my uncles grew up listening to their father, my grandfather, played duets with Louis Armstrong.
Really?
Yeah, piano and trumpet. So,
yeah. Is that still the same piano, by the way, that's in your uncle's house?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay, because he's got some piano.
That's an old-ass piano.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was like, whoa.
You've been there.
Oh, I've been there, man. I've been there. So that you're taking this project on the road in November, is that kind of the plan?
It's debuting in Switzerland and Germany in November.
Okay. And then you were talking a little bit off camera, so you're doing stuff in Switzerland, and then you're also touring a little bit, right? Aren't you doing some other things?
I plan to showcase next week.
Yep.
Well, actually, before that, I go to Ann Arbor, in Michigan. I just came from Syracuse and Auburn, and then I'll do the showcase next week. And then after showcase, I go back to Europe, and I go to Germany and Austria with some projects. This project I was telling you about, Exotica, which is a trio I have with
this project sounds really interesting. Talk a little bit about this, because it sounds real interesting, and I think this is something that we need to talk about getting to Chicago at some point.
Well, this project is called Exotica, Chico Freeman's Exotica, and the first thing that makes it interesting is the percussionist who's playing with me. He's a Swiss guy, and he plays a particular instrument. It's called hang. It's spelled hang, like in English, you know, just hang. But it's in Swiss German, it's pronounced hang. And it means playing with your, it means hand. And it's played with your hands. And it's like two woks.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know.
The wok pots?
Concave, yeah. You know, and put together like that. And they're indentations in, and they make, and they're pitched.
And I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. I've seen
and then on the top is a logo, you know. Mm-hmm. And he invented this instrument. This is the guy.
Oh, he did?
That's what I'm saying. His name is Reto Weber. He's the inventor. He came up with the idea, and he found a guy who could make it. You know, he didn't make it himself. He didn't put it together, but he invented it. And he did that, and so then he got it. So he was the first person to play it. He's got three or four of them now, and he does that. And now they've got a whole bunch of people playing it around, and they even have a convention that they started to do, and he goes to these places.
Yeah.
But anyway, he plays it. So this instrument has a unique sound, and I like it's very mellow, beautiful sound, unique. And so this Exotica it started out as a trio with the hong, but he also plays African water drums, and he plays djembe. So he's a percussionist, and I have a cellist. And this cellist, his name is Svante Henriksson. He's an incredible cellist, an incredible musician. He's a Swedish guy, bad man. And we have this thing. But then I also sometimes use a bassist. His name is Harry Kancik. And then sometimes I use them both,
wow,
cello and bass. So Exotica with that. And then I'm playing with saxophones and bass clarinet and all of that, and I've written music for this particular thing, and we've had some beautiful music.
You can find this band on YouTube,
and I have a YouTube channel, and you'll see it.
And it's ChicoFreeman.com, right? Is it the website?
That's
your website, so it's probably linked
over
there
too. But YouTube, yeah, you have a link to YouTube, and you can hear a couple of songs on there. But so this tour, this band is touring in October.
Wow!
And so I go back to do that in October, then November. I bring over the voices, and we have a tour of Switzerland and Germany.
Wow.
And they're working on a tour for next year, for 2020.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping to bring it here to the States, and in particular here to Chicago.
It's got to come to Chicago.
Yeah, Chicago, I mean, it's
Chicago. It has to come to Chicago. Yeah.
So that's wow. What that is.
Well, I'm so glad that we got to sit down and talk a little bit, man. This was unbelievable. Chico Freeman, of course, ChicoFreeman.com. Of course, keep up to date on everything that's happening. We're going to link
also
everything up below.
Also, my Facebook page.
Facebook?
You can find a lot of information on me on Facebook and, of course, on my website.
Well, we'll link everything up. But
yeah.
Thanks so much, man.
Thank you,
I really
Mike.
Appreciate it. Okay. And, of course, you can see all the videos and all the other interviews on ChicagoJazzMagazine.com, ChicagoJazz.com. But I'm so glad we got to sit down with you. You got the Selmer sitting right in front of us here.
I'm a Selmer and Dorsey saxophone. Been playing them for many, many, many years.
Yeah. Well, and this is a hip-looking Selmer, too, by the way.
Sounds good.
So thanks for watching. We appreciate you being here for the feature interview October 2019. And until next time, we will see you somewhere out on the scene.